Welcome to the App Happen Podcast, episode 90, a podcast by IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Jerry.
And in this episode, we talk about Terraform.
We talk about storage systems.
We talk about Kubernetes.
And we also talk about tags versus hostnames. So without further ado, let's get on with the show.
Right, we're back for another episode. Yeah, I was just going to say about talk about Terraform. I mentioned in our little chat is that I like how we kind of our little kind of podcast. We can talk about things a couple of months ago, and then it just all clicks when we start talking when I'm doing stuff at work. Things like how we were talking about modules in Terraform a couple of episodes ago, and how you use them. I wasn't really understanding kind of why you were using modules, but I fully understand why you want to use modules, especially when your Terraform script gets quite large. I haven't really started using Terraform modules yet because all the things I've done so far is not very repeatable kind of thing, because every time I do something, it's kind of bespoke, if that makes sense. So, yeah, I just wanted to say kind of that I like how it doing how we talk about stuff in one episode helps me kind of get with the point of the podcast, helps me kind of understand the technology more kind of thing. And I've also been using remote states as well. I don't think we talked about it on the show, have we? Remote state files, or
I think we might have touched on it in the past.
Mm.
Yeah.
Probably not a dedicated section on it, but yeah, we've probably just mentioned it in passing at some point.
Yeah. So yeah, it's just like with the state file in Terraform, it's kind of holds the state of what your kind of infrastructure is. Can you actually import stuff into Terraform state file? I've only ever done it where creating stuff from scratch.
You can. And in fact, actually, there's another thing as well with Terraform state files is that if you use something like Terraformer, which is something that the AWS team created, I think, where actually, or was it the Google Cloud?
I think it was the Google one, if my memory serves me.
Yeah, where it'll read an environment into a set of Terraform files and will create the associated state file with it as well. Which I've not actively used. I've seen it's there. I've never really done much with it, but that seems quite useful.
Yeah,
and it's not limited to Google Cloud either. So
yeah, we tried it once at my last place, because there's a lot of stuff we had in AWS from either using CloudFormation or just people clicking around in the console and creating things. The problem is it essentially creates almost bespoke Terraform files for each of them rather than, you know, a bit modular, at which point you've almost got to work it back anyway. And it was easier for us to create the resources and then import them than it was to actually let Terraformer do its thing. It's probably good, you know, if you're starting from scratch or if you've got very identical infrastructure, but for us it just ended up making things a bit more difficult actually when we started trying to use it.
Hmm.
So say you were to create a piece of infrastructure by hand, importing into the state file is the equivalent of letting Terraform know it's there. So when you come to do a Terraform plan or apply, then it doesn't try to recreate the same bit of infrastructure or destroy what's there and recreate another one.
Mostly. There is one thing that I have seen it struggles quite hard with, which is if you use Cloud Init files or the sort of equivalent in Azure, which is user data files, because it doesn't know that there was a user data file included in it. If you imported a VM or a disk, it will basically say, oh, I don't know what that is. It's out of state with what the Terraform file says. So it will then destroy it and rebuild it, which obviously if it's a complex beast, it'll kind of go, oh, don't know what that's for.
Yeah, the importing, as I say, we use a lot at my old place, but just generally for sometimes, as I say, just building CloudFormation, and then actually when we started migrating to Terraform, it was kind of easy to import some parts, but then in other ways, it was actually just easier to build brand new infrastructure and move across. So yeah, import's useful if you just wanted to try something, then go, you know what, now I want it in Terraform. Sometimes it's actually just better to do it from scratch.
I think I've used it before when I somehow lost my state file or I accidentally deleted it, and I ended up going in and I had the Terraform code. I just had to tell it that the resources were actually there. So, Terraform import, and then it's fairly easy in Azure anyway to just grab the last bit of the URL and import it that way. So go into the web portal, the Azure web portal, grab the last bit of the URL and do Terraform import and do it that way. And it will kind of match it up to what's in your code. It works pretty well.
Interesting. I might have to try that because one of the projects I'm working on at the moment is building it into our staging environment because they've built it. They haven't built it in dev properly because they've got one way of doing it. We want it done a different way in staging, which could go into production live, but I've got to kind of rebuild it back into dev retrospectively thing. So I might try that and seeing how that kind of works. Yeah, we'll go back to the remote state file. I've been using it with Azure Blob Storage and it worked quite well with our small team of five people. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. I've been following a guide on YouTube with a guy who shows you it. He does Terraform document or just telling you how to use Terraform, and it's got some really good sections in it. So I'll put a link in the show notes, basically kind of from what I've been watching. Do you guys use much about the output.tf at all, or what you would kind of use that for in real life?
Yes, I use that a lot. So I nearly always have an output of what the IP addresses are that I've built. Even if I've got a DNS name that associates to it, I still have the IP addresses of boxes. I also have a blog post that I did a while back about the standard usernames and passwords for various AWS AMI files. So the AWS AMIs for Ubuntu, CentOS, Red Hat, Fedora, Debian, Windows, they all have kind of standard usernames and passwords. Not so much the Windows one, but anyway, they have these standard credentials. On Azure, it's a bit different because on Azure, you can specify a username and password. But with these other platforms, you kind of have a username and password that's associated to them. And I actually wrote a thing to use a map of what the machine was that you've loaded and use that to kind of have an output of what the username and password is, or at least what the username is, definitely. But I also have things like if I know that I'm not going to be accessing the machines over normal SSH, or if there's some specific flags around the identity file that I'm using, I'll specify them in there as well.
So that's like if you do a plan, is that what you're saying? Oh, sorry, if you're doing an output.
Yeah, so when I build an infrastructure, so that's usually, a firewall and a virtual machine or two virtual machines or, a cluster of virtual machines. Each of those machines I will hand back. So they'll be created in a module and I'll create an output from the module to hand back to the root of what the IP address was that was built and what's the username and potentially what the password is or which SSH key I've used. So that I can then say in the root module an output of here's the username, password, IP address for each of the machines.
Have you guys used it with adding the plan, as in when you do a plan?
So you have outputs from the plan talking about? Yeah, so in that case, those are outputs from the root module. So in Terraform, what calls all the other modules is the root module. So you're using outputs to get values from the modules to other modules, but also back to the root module. And if you're in the root module and you have an output there, it's not passing to any other modules, so it prints it out. That's basically how it works. And you can output as JSON as well. I think it outputs in HCL by default, but you can also output in JSON, so you can take your outputs of the root module and pass that potentially onto something else or into an API or something like that.
Yeah, I was just going to say exactly what Jerry said in terms of the exposing from a variable from a module or something that's been created from a module and then passing it to another. A good example of that one in my last place was having the same service but in multiple different regions, we'd want to use an IAM role, which is basically the access management for it. We'd want the same role applied, but it's specific to that region, at which point we'd have to prefix it for one very simple reason. In the same AWS account but different regions, IAM roles are globally significant, so it means that if you try and create one with the same name, it won't work because there's already one that exists, even if it's in a different region. So we'd need something that prefixes it with a region or a unique identifier, at which point we can then pass that to another part that needs that IAM role attaching or something like that. So it means that, you know, you build it, you output it with whatever string that you've created from it, and then you can pass it to the next module to work with. And it's one of the best reasons for outputs for me, is to be able to take from one module and pass it to another. Being able to display it in front of you is also useful, but yeah, that is probably, I think, the main use case for it.
Potentially, you could take the output of a module and then pass that to the root module unaltered almost, so you can get an output from the non-root module to be printed out by calling it from the root module, basically. So if you need to get a value from a module, for instance, you can do it that way. I also wanted to quickly follow up on Terraform state. There is there's a Terraform state command with a bunch of subcommands. So you can do things like list your state, or I think you do show list. You can remove things from the state manually and things like that. So I've used that before when the state, the plan, there was something up with the plan. It wasn't planning or applying properly, and it was because something existed in the state file that didn't exist in the actual infrastructure. So by doing Terraform state RM, I was able to remove the offending bit of the state, and the plan apply worked.
One little trick, just slightly going back to the Terraform import as well in relation to state. Ever since Terraform version 0.12, they now show the plans in the HCL output rather than just a list of fields. And the useful part about that is each resource in Terraform has the default minimum fields you need to fill in. So what you can use that for is to put the default minimum fields in. So let's say, for an AWS, you do an EC2 instance, for example, and you just do the resource, the EC2 instance, the name of it, and the type that it's going to be, and just put that in, but then import what exists, and then it will tell you what changes are needed to be made. When you see what changes need to be made, you can almost copy and paste that straight into your file, and that is exactly how the instance exists, and then it matches what's in the what you've created in AWS at that point. So it's almost like an easy button for saying, what Terraform things do I need to supply? Well, go for the defaults, import it, and then it'll tell you what's missing, and then you can just make use of that. I've done that a few times just to, you know, as I say, potentially CloudFormation or all of this other stuff, just to say, I want the code, and I can't quite get every single part right at this one. So it just shows exactly what you need at that point.
Al mentioned before about having some infrastructure that someone else had built before and that they wanted to kind of reuse inside one of their tasks. It's not exactly the same thing, because I think Al wants to kind of almost rebuild it using his Terraform files. But one of the things that I've done before is I've had two separate playbooks, one for deploying the VPC or VNet, depending on which environment I was in, and the subnets and all the bits that kind of don't change between environments. And then a separate one that uses the name or the tags of those resources that I've created in the first playbook as data fields in the second one, so that there's no chance of me destroying elements of that I created in the first one with the second one. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because it's worth mentioning for anyone that's not used Terraform before, particularly if you're used to working in an ops heavy environment that hasn't done much in the way of infrastructure as code before, is that what some people see as the downsides to Terraform is that you can destroy a whole environment using Terraform destroy. And that will basically tear down everything that Terraform provisioned for you. So if you had like a set of an operating environment like a security hub or something like that, or a bastion subnet and sort of access rules from there to everything else. And you didn't want that ever being removed. With the, unfortunately, with the Terraform destroy command, you could potentially wipe that lot out. So what you could do is have it, as I said, in a separate playbook that, that provisions your common underlying infrastructure, and then have a second one that deploys the individual components that you're talking about. So you could have a separate one that deploys your database tier, for example, and a separate one that deploys your web server tier. So if you then need to change elements of that, you're just deploying that that piece that you're talking about, and not the whole blanket playbook.
Yeah, well, one of the nice things there as well, which, you know, as you say, a lot of people don't like the Terraform destroy command, but actually it can be quite useful in terms of you may have been building something up over time and going, I'm not sure if I rebuilt this, if it'd work the same way, because I've made that many changes since I've started this, you know, like adding an instance, adding a rule here, removing this, trying this. You do a Terraform destroy and then bring it back up, you know for a certain whether what you built will actually work the second time, which, you know, there's quite a few problems that we've found at my last place where we've gone, actually, when we redid that again, half of it didn't work correctly. So yeah, there was always a policy put in place of if you build new infrastructure and it's going to go into even staging, you have to do a Terraform destroy first on a local state file before you bring it into the main environments, and then you know for a fact whether it will stand up or not.
I guess that's something you'd want to try in a non-production environment. You wouldn't want to do Terraform destroy on a production environment.
No. I think that's called a resume generating event.
Yeah. So what's it? SpaceX rapid unscheduled disassembly.
Yep.
Or explosion. And a quick point on Terraform state as well. Remote state. You can take advantage of file versioning. In at least in AWS and Azure, so each time the state file changes, the storage service will keep the old version. So any problems, you can usually roll back to a previous version of the state with no problems.
Yeah. So thanks for that. I'll put a link in the show notes about the guest Will Brooks YouTube series. It's quite a good little series about very good primer for it. I preferred that compared to the course I was watching on Pluralsight. So yeah, that's good. Next one, we talk about CentOS 6 end of life and Ubuntu 16.04 end of life.
Yeah, this is just a quick one from me regarding various OS's becoming end of life. So I was caught out by CentOS 6 on end of life November 30th last year. I found this out when I went to do a Yum update on some servers that I look after, and found that it wasn't working. And the reason for that was because CentOS had made those repos unavailable. So I've got some clients that need sorting out. I best say no more because their servers are currently unable to be updated. So yeah, there's that. Also, Ubuntu 16.04, it will be end of life on April the 30th this year. So anyone running 16.04 machines should look to upgrade them to at least 18.04. And the other thing is that CentOS 8 is end of life at the end of this year because it's going to CentOS Stream. So if anyone's running that, just be aware and don't get caught out like I did.
Yes, it's still an interesting topic, the whole CentOS 8 thing. But yeah, I think there's enough podcasts that have covered that to death now. So
yeah.
So hopefully we get this episode out before April 30th to warn people. So yeah, the next thing on the docket here is AKS. So this is, I don't know if anyone else, if any of you guys have used it. It's Azure's Kubernetes service.
Is it worth quickly mentioning what Kubernetes is?
Okay, yeah, right. So Kubernetes is a way of running containers, basically, in a declarative manner. It came out of, I believe, Google's container job scheduling system.
It was called Borg, their system, yeah.
Not to be confused with the backup software. And yeah, so they open sourced it, or built another version of it and open sourced it to the world. And a lot of places are now running, using it to run containers, kind of coming out of the rise of the Docker and people running or basically releasing software as containers. Although Kubernetes now doesn't run Docker, or the ability to run Docker natively has been taken out, I think. So you have to build non-Docker container images now.
No, that's not quite right.
Okay.
So as I understand it, and bear in mind, I don't tend to use Docker or Kubernetes much in my day-to-day job at the moment. But as I understand it, Docker and Kubernetes both use the Open Container Initiative common OCI format. The piece that was removed from Kubernetes was a shim to the old Docker executable. And in fact, if you look at how Docker does things now themselves, they actually shell out to the OCI binary themselves. So all that's happened is that Kubernetes is now following the same pattern that Docker is. So it's not that they're not using Docker, because they're still using the pieces of that Docker are using. It's just the runtime that actually executes the container and kind of has the services running in the background. That's what's changed.
Right.
You can still use things like Docker files and what have you to build the containers in the first place. I mean, a good example is where I am at the moment. We use OpenShift, and that actually doesn't use Docker in the back end. It uses CRIO, I think, which is another version of container management. And yeah, all the images that are built, you still use Docker files. You could potentially use other stuff to do it, but we use Docker files to build them. But it's built using Builder and Podman in our environment, and then they're pushed into OpenShift to use the CRIO, and it all works mostly seamlessly. The only difference is that OpenShift itself and things like Podman use what's called rootless containers. And the difference between a normal container and a rootless container is Docker originally, and I think it still does, its processes run as root. So if you were somehow able to break out the container itself, you would have root privileges. Whereas anything that runs inside a rootless container is as the user that the container runs as, not root. So it's, you know, a bit of a better security focus at that point. And yeah, as I say, that if you're used to something where it can run as root in a container in Docker, and you try and use that in something like Podman or similar, it's not going to work quite right. Whereas 99% of the stuff from what I've seen works fine. Although I have come across the odd issue where actually it was kind of depending on a few file permissions as root. So yeah, there's a few different ways of going about it now.
I mean, Kubernetes is quite a big topic anyway. There's loads of stuff out there about it. What I'm going to just cover is the bits of Azure's Kubernetes service that I have interacted with. So Azure has a concept of resource groups, and that is what it sounds like. Every resource in Azure belongs to a resource group. When you create a cluster in AKS, Kubernetes cluster, so that's like a unit. You can have multiple Kubernetes clusters, but a cluster is just a unit which has its own internal networking. It runs a group of containers, various other bits and bobs. By default, the way it works is it creates two resource groups. One is the AKS resource group, and that basically has the Kubernetes resource, if you like, and that's the control plane that you connect to, and the way that you interact with Kubernetes. The tool that you use is called kubectl, and I don't think it contains a lot else. The other thing is what's called the node resource group. By default, that's prefixed with MC_. That has things like other resources. So Kubernetes basically works by running a group of nodes, usually VMs, can be bare metal, and that's where the containers run. And it uses various kind of tricks of the the Linux kernel and Linux networking to make it so that you can run a container and you can do things like have replicas of containers on each node, on each physical, in inverted commas, node. And this node resource group is where all those resources live. So the nodes themselves, it actually has like a concept of a node pool where you specify a size of VM and it will just create nodes as needed. And they sit in this thing called a node pool. And you don't have to manage the VM separately. So the advantage of that is if you were not running a managed Kubernetes service, you'd have to manage those nodes, which is obviously extra management overhead. The other thing that it offers is something called AAD pod identity. So this is a way of tying the Kubernetes role-based access control to an Azure managed identity. So what that lets you do is we touched briefly on managed identities in either last episode or a couple of episodes ago. Managed identities in Azure are basically another resource, but they allow you to specify an identity which can perform various tasks. So things like you can manipulate DNS records, for instance, and using AAD pod identity, you can tie that role in Kubernetes to that managed identity outside Kubernetes and do interesting things like setting up DNS records out in Azure from your Kubernetes cluster.
So I suppose in a sense that's exposing Azure-based permission systems, but almost directly to the pod at that point and limiting what can use it rather than just anything within the cluster can use it at that point.
So RBAC, Kubernetes RBAC, which I've only started using in the last year or so, will limit things that pods within pod being a either one container or a group of containers within the Kubernetes cluster. RBAC will limit what that pod can do within the cluster. And using this AAD pod identity, you can tie that to a managed identity outside the cluster. So that's good from a security point of view, obviously. So that's the bits of AKS that I have myself covered. Maybe some of you out there have played with it and have other news of things that it can do. But I don't think any of you guys have used it, have you?
No. So we did have it because, as I said before, the couple of our applications we have at work still run as Windows servers. So we're looking at using that to kind of containerize those servers because obviously we're still using VMs. I'm looking at a project at the moment as well, which is again looking at, they've got some service which runs on some random port, which they're going to ask the developers to kind of try to put into some sort of container. So that's where I kind of need to understand it. So if I understand what you're saying is that with the AKS, you're basically just creating loads of nodes for your containers to run on so they can be highly available. Is that correct? Is that what we're saying?
That is one of the advantages of using Kubernetes.
There's a part of high availability. There's also the sides that you can place things like resource requests and limits on them, so you can say how much a container should be able to use, and then what is the hard limit to say something like, you know, for example, a container can use at maximum 1 gig of memory and 1 CPU, at which point if it goes over that, if it hits the CPU limit, it'll start to rate limit it down until it comes back under that. If it goes over on memory, there's no way of rate limiting that. It will just literally kill the container, but it does mean you can start placing some limits on that. And it also gets people into the idea of the application can disappear, so the container can die. So try and make it highly available. Try and make it not if this goes, everything falls apart. It's almost a different way of thinking. And it also means that, you know, if a container does die for whatever reason, you can still, the Kubernetes control plane will make sure it restarts somewhere. And, you know, if it keeps, you know, erroring out or exiting, then it will say that, you know, it goes into something called a crash loop back off, which it'll try and run it again. If it exits again, it'll then back off a little bit more, and then it'll do it again, it'll back up more again. They call it the exponential back off, so it means that it's not just, you know, constantly trying, but it still means that at some point, if the application recovers, you know, I don't know, DNS isn't available or what the API endpoint it's trying to get to is out, it will eventually return rather than just going down and staying down.
But why would that be? Why would that just be a way of doing microservices? Is that just a way? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yeah, exactly. So the idea behind Kubernetes, rather than just a host running Docker, is that Docker can make a container run, but it's not good for doing it across multiple nodes. The Docker itself is just essentially contained to a single node. That node disappears, the containers don't have anywhere to run, whereas in Kubernetes world, the control plane knows that needs to run somewhere. If it notices the node goes away, it will then move it to a different node instead, at which point the container will run somewhere else. And again, if multiple resources go away or the API endpoint they're trying to get to, it will die, but then it will come back up at some point. And as I say, rather than it just trying over and over to come back up, there's the exponential back off. So it actually gives your resources a bit of breathing space rather than just getting hammered by every container trying to restart at once.
Okay. But haven't we spoken about in the past that Kubernetes can be too big sometimes to do the job that you're doing? There's something like this, like there's like an in-between kind of bit of software which can do it.
There's a couple of things. I mean, I've not used it yet, but HashiCorp's Nomad does seem to do that, and that can do manage just system services. It can manage containers, that kind of thing. Essentially, it's just running jobs or services at that point. And that, from what I understand, as I say, I've not tried it yet, but in reading up about it, it is a much simpler job scheduler. But I think also at the same time, one, there's less industry weight behind it, but I think it's not quite as flexible in that sense. So yeah, there are other things out there that can take care of it. But yeah, I mean, as I say, there's a lot of industry weight behind Kubernetes as well. So if improvement's going to come somewhere, it's probably there. But at the same time, it's also a very complex beast at the same time. So if something is going to go wrong, it's probably Kubernetes as well.
Yeah, it's a lot to learn, Kubernetes. That's the main thing.
Yeah, because I think it was Joe used it before, isn't it? You did something else. I don't know. I need to start having a look at it. I'm still looking at the pricing and then how it kind of all hangs together.
Yeah, I mean, not everywhere needs it as well. I mean, my last place, we were starting to look into Kubernetes a bit, but it didn't end up going beyond proof concepts because we used AWS is what they call it, Elastic Container Service, which is managed Docker. But what it would do is if a node died, it would move containers elsewhere. And also it was spread across multiple nodes at that point. The problem is it was very, very simple. There wasn't a lot you could do with it. But at the same time, if all you needed was the minimum requirements, you didn't need the flexibility that Kubernetes got. It was a lot simpler to manage as well. So I think there's an equivalent in Azure as well. I don't know the name of it, but it's probably sort of like ACS or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there is something easier, but I don't know what it is. It's not very helpful.
Yeah, that's what we just said. Something else. Is it something small? Is it KG8 or something? KG8S or something, which we talked about before?
K3S is, yeah, that's... It's created... I think, was it originally created by the people at Rancher or this? And K3S is essentially, it's kind of like a stripped-down version, so it removes things like the... what's it called? There's a lot of feature flags and there's a lot of beta features, a lot of features coming, and things like that. And K3S just is the what is stable now is what goes into K3S. And rather than using etcd, which is a key value store, it's basically where Kubernetes stores its config. K3S by default uses SQLite, which is a bit easier to manage, but not quite as flexible and not as highly available as etcd. But at the same time, it's almost like a minimum viable Kubernetes rather than, you know, the full bells and whistles you'd get with sort of like Kubernetes or even, you know, managed thing like AKS or something like that.
It lets you run Kubernetes on a single node, which is what I'm using at home. So basically running services on my home server, but using K3S. So I'm trying to run everything in Kubernetes just to basically learn how to use it. Using K3S to do it. I think you can join multiple nodes together, which is what I'm intending to do once I've cleared some space on some other machines. So I'll report back on that.
Cool. Just something I'm just going to put in the show notes. There's a kind of a link to a blog post about tags versus host names, which is a big kind of topic at my place at the moment. Is that the DevOps team, which we are at the moment, is taking over what the old DevOps team did, and it's kind of all kind of get into what the way we want the new DevOps team wants to work with. And a lot of this, before we kind of started, there was like no control of what resources were made and stuff, and so we've got things like with either like PRD in it or PROD or pre-prod or testing. So all of it's a bit of a mess. So it's quite interesting leading this blog post. One of my colleagues found, and I'll kind of put it in the show notes, about that. Should you really care about what you're doing with your host or your names and your resources, or you should be using tagging? And I've been using tagging as well, as long as the host names as well. So tagging is a way that you can tag resources. So you could say things like what environment it's in, who curated it, when it was curated. If it's related to a cost center, you can then do things like that. And also in Azure, you can, I don't know if you can do this in Amazon, AWS, that you can do policies where you can limit, you can define what things are called. Depending on what environment you're putting in. So that's quite good. And that can get you, that's quite good, because when we were building this new environment, it stopped us kind of creating stuff with production names or test names in it as well. But also it can get you as well, because sometimes if you're creating resources, like definitely like a private endpoint, which is like a way of, if you got like, you know, you get PaaS services like PaaS SQL or, anything platform, you can basically present that internally onto a VNet. And what you can do is you can do it private endpoint. This means you can crazy present it out onto a VNet and it's not presentable on the internet. And what that does is creates a virtual NIC, but you can't define what that virtual NIC is going to be called. So that can kind of break your policies, which I've kind of hit my head against the wall a couple of times. Why is it not working? Or someone came to me saying, why isn't this storage account creating in this environment? I'm going, and it was basically due to policy.
You can also have limitations on resource names. So storage accounts are quite restrictive in Azure. They have to be, I think it's 21 characters and no dashes and things like that. So
it has to be all lowercase as well.
Yeah.
It's all like you'll have different rules depending on, again, in my Terraform stuff, I tend to have like a specific naming convention for all the objects. And if you've got a naming policy on, like you said, resource groups can have certain things in, and then storage accounts can have different sets of characters in there. You almost kind of need them all to have the same thing. But I think from the article that you called out there, the one of the criticisms about host names is that Windows host names can only be a certain number of characters long. I think it's 16 characters long. And obviously Linux machines, I think, is 63 characters. But AWS and Azure can both have sort of an arbitrary length host name that aren't then passed down to the machine itself. So the machine doesn't know its own host name until you tell it to look at the directory service, whether that's, you know, EC2 tagged names or Azure virtual machines host names, because you can't rely on the tags, because tags are an arbitrary thing that the hypervisor itself is providing to you, whereas a hostname is something specific to that machine. So if you're expecting logs to come from a specific machine name, you're not going to get that. So there's kind of, there are reasons why you might want to go with a hostname over a tag. The other thing that I find quite useful about tags, particularly if you're using vendor firewall technologies, is that you can define a policy between two sets of tags, or between a CIDR mask and all the objects in a tag. So I particularly found this with Fortinets. You can give Fortinets an EC2 or an Azure service account or IAM role. That it means that, and you can do the same with ESXi as well, where you can basically say to it, go and find everything that matches these tags descriptions. So for example, if you wanted to say web servers, anyone can talk to a web server on 80.443, but you can only talk to database servers on 33, wherever the database ports are. And you can only talk to those database ports from machines that have got this tag on them, which you can't do that at all with any of the native security, or at least the last time I looked at it, you couldn't do that with the security controls for either Azure or AWS.
Yeah, yeah, I don't remember seeing anything like that in them, so yeah.
I know you definitely can't do it with AWS. It's just, it's been a while since I've looked at security groups in Azure.
Yeah. In terms of the whole tags versus host names thing, there is an element here as well, which are host names are relevant where you're treating things a bit more like pets. So it goes the whole, you know, we've mentioned it before, but it's the pets versus cattle, where, you know, a pet is something you look after, you feed, you make sure that that's run a certain way, whereas cattle, it's the whole idea of that can be here and then it can just, you know, disappear and it doesn't matter. So one of the advantages for cloud providers in general is the idea of scaling groups. Don't know if it's called the same in Azure, I'm trying to remember, but in AWS it's called an auto-scaling group, and the idea is that for a certain resource, if it hits a certain threshold, so, you know, whether it's traffic coming in, whether it's a queue length of messages that it needs to process, whatever the reason, it will then scale up the instances to then take on that workload. If you've got a specific hostname convention, when that scaling group increases and then decreases, you've just had a host that has a host name that it doesn't exist anymore, for example, which is why in that sense tags become more relevant, because then you can see at this point there was 50 instances that were tagged with this job ID and now it's down to 30, so it must have had an increase in traffic at that point. And it's a similar thing in Kubernetes, and OpenShift, for example, has the built-in cluster autoscaler. And what that does is when there is more workloads than nodes to fill it, it will scale out, bring a worker up that can take the workload. And then once that workload is no longer requiring the same set of resources, or it's moved elsewhere, and then it'll remove that node. And again, the whole idea of a host name being relevant at that point when it's a node that's going to disappear. It's why for me tags are, especially in cloud providers with scaling, they're far more relevant than host names at that point. And one of the other things, especially with when it comes to logging in that scenario, a lot of the logging providers that are more cloud native now include the tags, include a lot of the metadata that you would get from something like AWS to, you know, pinpoint what the service was for, rather than, you know, this individual instance and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's a lot more that, you know, tags can bring you in that sort of scenario.
At the same time, you have to name your instances something. So, you know, a name is like one of those default values of an instance resource. So you have to think of something to call it, or something as like a base of what to call it, I guess. Or a base of the auto-scaling group or whatever.
So to a certain extent, you kind of don't need to, because the machines are given, they either call themselves whatever the vendor called its machine image when they built it. So it might be called, I don't know, let's say ABC 123, something like that. Or it might be called Ubuntu or, you know, Windows. Certainly with AWS, when you build a virtual machine, unless you give it the tag name and then the value of whatever you want it to be, whatever the host name you want to give it. If you don't give it that, it just gives it, it doesn't name it at all. And in fact, you have to actually go into the machine and tell it install the AWS CLI tools to find out what its own host name is supposed to be from the AWS console, effectively.
Mm. Well, I think you can curl the metadata endpoint for that.
Yeah, possibly. But certainly, like the actual tags, though, if you wanted to say, you know, is this machine a database server, you'd have to have certain tools in place to do that. Maybe the host name is a separate value. But yeah, I think on the whole, you tend to get most of the meta. The machine itself doesn't need to know its own host name. I must admit, I do tend to put in the cloud init scripts, I will name you this. But like you said, if you've then got a scale group, you can't have an instruction to name itself something unless you tell it to, you know, as you're standing yourself up, please go and, you know, download this build script from GitHub or GitLab or Bitbucket or whatever it might be, to name yourself from that.
Yeah, and I know in AWS as well, a lot of time if you don't give instances a host name, you might end up with one of their default ones, which is of like IP and then whatever the IP is, and it's just hyphens rather than dots, and you'll get .ec2.internal. So technically you will get a host name, but again, it's not entirely relevant now. I guess the point is naming conventions when it came to, you know, on-prem or work or, you know, your own managed servers, your metadata was the host name itself. So your host name would tell you whether it was production, it would tell you what was running it now. Whereas if you've got the ability to use tags, you don't particularly need it. It's helpful for when you're logged into it, something like that. But actually you can get more metadata out of a tag and, you know, forming them a bit better, you know, rather than having to concatenate and having to form it so it makes sense without being too long. Almost doesn't matter now, you've got as much metadata as you want to work with.
The other thing as well that having stuff on-prem, having a host name on-prem would be useful for, is that if you had a machine fail or you wanted your operations team to go and look at a box in a data center, for example, you tend to give it the machine name.
Yeah.
Because it would be printed on a label that was stuck on the front of the box.
Yes.
So they'd go to the rack in, you know, row 3, column 4, whatever, and they'd have to look down that rack to find the piece of sticky tape that had the name of the server on it.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to cloud, you don't have that problem.
Yeah. And then half the time there you say it's in U14 and just go, that's not what's in here, and you find out your diagrams are out of date, but, you know, always the way.
We're going to have a great discussion. That'd be quite a good discussion. I like having these kinds of discussions because, like, people can quite get at work, they get a high rate about what we should be calling in different environments and stuff and kind of thing. Maybe it could be like a talk at OggCamp or something. Be quite interesting to kind of, have a chat about.
So just as a little anecdote for that one, back when I started in the team that I sort of left most recently, our standard route out to the internet was via a pair of Cisco routers, which were called Greece and Norway. And on one occasion, one of those routers died. So they phoned Cisco and said, one of our routers has died and it's called Greece. And the poor tech on the end of the line thought that all of Greece had gone out. And they kind of, it went immediately to a sort of P1, oh my God, disaster, you know, all of Greece has gone black.
And you've just got a failover router that's gone down.
Given how easy it seems to be to get routing, you know, international routing tables wrong, it's not too far-fetched.
Yeah. given one of our show topics on the backlog and has been there for about sort of 6 months now, has been about BGP, we'll save that conversation for another time.
Yes.
And if you, dear listener, want to know more about BGP, please contact us and let us know that you want us to prioritise that item in the backlog.
I'm sure that Stu will have a great time about telling us those kind of things.
I can wax lyrical on BGP for days, don't worry. I'll bore you all by the end of it, don't worry.
The one thing I want to mention as well before we kind of wrap up is that I've been kind of at home been messing about with my home kind of NAS via hypervisor kind of thing, which kind of holds my Plex server and various other points, was running Snap Raid, and I can't think, what is it? Was it Merger FS? And I, over Christmas, I had a clicking noise from my server, and one of my drives had died. It actually managed to 7 years. It managed to the device down it. So I needed to rebuild it. I basically got up and running. I got most of the data back, and luckily I had backups. But again, the problem is having children and stuff is not getting enough time to kind of prioritize your kind of things to rebuild it. So I've been playing with Unraid, and I've been really impressed with it. Which you have to purchase it. Which is kind of like so I've still got my own piece of my hardware, my drives in it. And it does the same sort of thing as the Unraid, Merger FS and the, whatever I said a minute ago about Snap Raid, but it does it all for you. And it does all the monitoring for you as well. And it does containers and it does virtualization. So for kind of just installing it onto a USB stick and booting it up, and it's so much easier and you haven't got to worry about. Because when my server went wrong, I had to go and look into my documentation and then kind of like work out what I had to do to restore it.
It's funny you should mention that. I was catching up on some podcast listening whilst I was doing dinner tonight. And I actually caught one of the recent episodes of the Two and a Half Admins podcast, in which Joe Ressington, being the voice of the dear listener, sort of asks his two experts. So the reason it's called Two and a Half Admins is because he's got two admins and Joe Ressington, who classes himself as not quite half an admin. So he asks the questions on behalf of kind of, you know, the person that doesn't really know much about technology. And one of the people there said, you know, I've got a friend who wants to, who's got just enough knowledge to be dangerous and wants to set up a NAS using something like Unraid. Should I let him do it?
It was an emphatic no from what I remember.
Yeah, Alan Jude was very negative.
I think because neither of them had actually used it. They're both big ZFS guys.
I don't think it's even so much that. So the main sort of response that came from... So Alan Jude, who is a big BSD guy... and is very much in the ZFS camp or ZFS camp, was like, you know, thou shalt only, he didn't say it like this, but effectively it was thou shalt use ZFS, and nothing but ZFS. The other guy, Jim
Salter,
was a bit more pragmatic in that what he basically said was, look, the only reason that you really want to use RAID is to reduce downtime. And they both kind of agreed at this point that, you know, if you've not got backups, then what was the phrase? If there's not three versions of the file effectively doesn't exist. That was the way that Alan referred to it as. And then they both basically said, look, if all you need is a tatty old box sitting under your, you know, under your stairs or in a cupboard somewhere that's saving you files, and you want it so that if one of those drive dies, you don't have to go and pull files from your backup, then yes, Unraid or, you know, any RAID style system will be fine for that. The main thing really is to make sure that you have got something to back that stuff up. Anyway, it's a good listen. You know, we like Joe Ressington. He's a good guy, and his podcasts generally seem to be quite positive. So if you want to go and listen to the Two and a Half Admins view on this particular segment, I'll dig out the episode from the show notes and stick it into our show notes.
Yeah, well, I'd like having a look at free NAS or whatever, but everyone seems with free NAS, you've got to have loads of RAM and stuff for it, whereas Unraid does do what I wanted to do. And when I wanted to set something up, I just Googled what I wanted to do and someone had already done it and it pointed you in a direction of the way to do it.
So the reason, as I understand it, and I might be horrifically outdated with this, the reason everyone says you need lots of RAM to do ZFS is because ZFS originated a few years back when having 4 gig of RAM in a machine was uncommon. Not rare, but uncommon. So the idea of having a machine with 4 gig of RAM, just as your NAS, was unthinkable. But nowadays, actually, the amount of RAM, it's fairly common to have 4 gig of RAM in a machine. So nowadays, that kind of concept of, oh my God, you need to have masses of RAM in your machine, is actually really outdated. But it's like the old, you need to know terminal to use Linux. We don't. You can drive a Linux desktop, mobile phones are Linux. Chromebooks are Linux. You don't need to know how to use a terminal to use Linux, but people still associate Linux with terminals in the same way that ZFS, they associate needing lots of RAM. You don't need lots of RAM.
I'd say it's less common to have 4 gig now because the minimum is usually 8 gig.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's also the point, yeah, as you're saying, ZFS, I think it originally came out early 2000s. It was back in the days that Sun Systems was around, and it was a couple of people there that came up with it. And back in them days, SSDs weren't a thing. NVMe especially wasn't. And I think there's an element that RAM was used as almost like a very small but cheap cache in some situations. Mm. Whereas actually now much faster drives are available, and using them as cache is probably just as good, if not better in some cases, because then you're not worried if your machine falls over or something like that. So
it's probably also why ZFS is kind of on standard Ubuntu now, the fact you've got more RAM to play with, maybe.
Well, no, the reason why ZFS adoption didn't pick up in Linux,
it was the licensing system thing, wasn't it?
The licensing, and even now, distributions like Fedora and Red Hat and CentOS will not ship. In fact, Ubuntu is the only distribution that will ship pre-built working ZFS stuff that is shipped as part of the core kernel. All of the rest of them require you to, Arch requires you to build it using DKMS. CentOS requires you to build it with, I don't think you can even install it under CentOS without invoking sort of all sorts of mythical beasts and sacrifices of goats and stuff. And it's purely down to the license, because the license is, if you are a license scholar that falls outside of the Ubuntu camp, the license is incompatible with the GPL, which is the GNU General Public License, which is the license that drives the Linux kernel development. And that was because the guy that ran Sun had a fundamental distaste of anything to do with Linux. So they developed a license that was incompatible with Linux, for that specific reason, because they didn't want anything to do with Linux. Sun was then bought by Oracle. Oracle has less of an issue with the GPL and the Linux kernel, because they're shipping their own Linux derivative called Oracle. It used to be called Oracle Unbreakable Linux, but now it's just Oracle Linux, I think. They're shipping things like MySQL on every platform there is going, including Linux. But still, this historic license is still there, and they will not remove it. The Ubuntu team's view is that they are both open source, free software style licenses that encourage the sharing and reuse of the code. So why can't we use it? If they were to take out a lawsuit against the Ubuntu project, it fundamentally disrupts both projects. People that are using it on Linux will stop using it because it becomes toxic. So I can see both sides of the camp, but unfortunately, I think Ubuntu is going to be the only distribution that ships ZFS for at least the next 5 to 10 years, I would say.
Yeah, hopefully in that time, BTRFS will have caught up, but we'll see.
I remember going to a talk at the first Odd Camp when someone was talking about BTRFS. I think you might even have been in the same room, Jerry.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And it was just like, like a not very good show at all, was it?
Yeah.
It was all the other calls, all the other things we've been really good at in testing. This whole room was packed about people waiting about hearing about it, and it was not very good at all.
Yeah, I think it was just a very specific use case, and the guy didn't actually know much about ButterFS. He's just talking about his experiences of it, and he wasn't really able to answer any questions about it. So, oh well, that's Odcamp for you, you know.
I think you'll find it's any unconference.
Yeah.
We'll have somebody there that wants to talk about something but has no idea how to, you know, what it is they want to talk about. Anyway, if you have been to a conference that's got someone like that there, fundamentally they still need to be celebrated for the fact they stood up in front of people to talk about something, because it's I think all of us I've certainly spoke at my fair share of conferences without really knowing a lot about what I was talking about.
Yeah, and that's how I wanted you to get you on the show in the first place, because you were talking about your 10 points about IP or whatever.
Oh, goodness me, that was some time ago now.
So anyway, we better start wrapping up, because it's getting...
We should.
Okay.
So I'd like to thank Dave for doing our audio production. Dave, I better have a word with you after this. we're now proud members of the Other Side Podcast Network. See otherside.network for more details.
And we'd like to thank our Patreons, who are Andamo, Andy, Dave, Maha, Mike, Stuart and Yannick. And all that goes to helping us produce this show. So thank you very much for that.
If you want to send us some feedback, if you want to tell us that we've got things wrong or that we've got things really right, we'd love to hear it from you. Please email mail@admin.podcast.co.uk, or you can join our Telegram group. You'll find the link in both the show notes and on our website.
If you've got any questions you want to answer, contact us by email or in our Telegram group, and with your question, and we'll try and answer it. So yeah, get your BGP questions in next time. and we'll speak to you all next time.
Take care.
Cheers.
Bye. Now it's over. I can open any door. Now it's over. I don't need you anymore. Now it's over. I can open any door. Now it's over.
I must sincerely apologise for the fact that I was falling asleep in this. I fail absolutely. Well, it doesn't help. The mute button on my microphone, I was hitting it like four or five times. You'll hear that in there as well. And I couldn't get it to mute. And in the end, I was just like, I'm just gonna sit here. The conversation's good, but I can't participate in this any further.
I could have sworn that I heard it and heard snoring, and it actually was. I thought it was just like... some heavy breathing going on or something.
I'm very sorry.
Been listening to a member of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at otherside.network.